Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Science of Sport podcast with sports editor Mike Finch and sports scientist Professor Ross Tucker.
So if you haven't joined our Discourse channel, you're missing out because there's lots of big discussions happening on our recently launched Discourse channel, but I don't think we can say recently launched because it's been going for well over a month now. And for those of you who want to know how to get onto that Discourse channel, if you're vaguely interested in anything to do with sports science, you can join our Patreon community and you can go to patreon.com and look for the Science of Sport podcast. And once you're on Patreon, you can donate a small amount of money. And it really is a relatively small amount of money. And then you get access to our Discourse channel. And Professor Ross Tucker, who's with me here at the moment, is there pretty much every single day and answering a lot of the questions, although you can't get to absolutely everything.
Oh, yeah. I'm still falling behind. I log on there and then there's a thing that says, how many unread categories have you got? And I despair every time I see, because I feel like I'm spending time, but the creation of content is just so rapid. And it's all good stuff. You know, it's people sharing their training experiences, yeah. People sharing podcasts they've listened to with a sports science slant, discussing our podcast, which is always added value for people. So it really has, I could not have imagined that it would have been any better than it's been. It's just been amazing. Yeah.
So if you are interested in this world of sports science that we talk about pretty much every single time we do a podcast, and you have friends who would like to be involved in that, don't forget you can also point them in that direction as well, as well as listening to our podcasts, which is kind of where we all started when we started doing this almost 5 years ago now. So today we have a very special podcast in that we had the opportunity to be involved with the team from World Rugby, and they invited us onto a panel discussion where they discussed the debate around spectacle versus the safety of the game of rugby union. And the main topics were really whether there is a weakening of the game, in other words, in terms of its spectacle, because of the safety of the players, or whether there was being enough done for the safety of the players. And I think, Ross, we'll see it during this podcast, and then what we'll do is we're going to literally play the panel discussion that happened, which contained some real knowledgeable people on it who really understand the game really, really well.
So I'm opinionated too, which was cool.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think what's fascinating about that is you get a real player's view, and we're going to be talking to some players who know the game really well to get their view on this whole debate. And it is something that World Rugby is grappling with, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, for the sake of disclosure, I'm part of the Welfare Week because I consult and do a lot of research for World Rugby and help, or try to help anyway, making some of the decisions around what we try and do for player welfare and how and so on. And it's funny, like in the last 6 months, I've become acutely aware of the tension and the trade-offs that exist between what we, player welfare, are trying to do and some of the barriers that exist from within the game. Not for selfish, stubborn reasons, but just because that's how it is. And that's one of the things that'll come out here. And it makes me question whether I was oblivious to it for the 4 years before, or whether there's something changing in the landscape. And maybe it's a little bit of both. I hope it's not only the former. But definitely in the last 6 months, there's been a shift in the voice of the game. And when I talk about the voice of the game, I'm for now excluding us, World Rugby's welfare side, from it. So that means you leave behind the coaches, the players, the match officials, who are not, it's too strong to say rejecting some of the safety initiatives, but they are holding their ground against some of those, and that's amplifying a degree of tension. And so I talk now about like the importance of collaboration. It's always been there, but you'll hear in the interviews that you're about to listen to and the opinions of Ugo and Kate and Sarah that it's not even about collaboration. It's about player welfare being player-led. You know, it's actually one behind the other, not lockstep. Because if the players and the match officials and especially the coaches don't buy in and they don't accept that, you will get exactly what you're about to hear from Ugo and Kate. And I was surprised to hear it. I was happy to hear it. We had no idea what they were going to say in response to our questions. But I was surprised at the direction that some of these answers took us in. I don't know about your expectations going in, but I was surprised because you often hear, often this debate just falls into cliche. Mm. Yeah, we really care about player welfare. We fully back, blah, blah, blah. That didn't come out in this. This was an honest conversation, I felt. I don't know what your thoughts were.
Yeah, I would agree. Before we kind of get into it, because we don't discuss this so much in the context of why this is important, you discuss some of the issues involved, but let's just talk about the context of why this debate and why this tension exists. Why does rugby have to look after the safety of players? Why can't it just continue the way it is?
Right now, the specific reason is concussion. Rugby is a concussion-generating sport. Because of the volume of exposure that it creates. You know, you've got 30 players for 80 minutes involved in 500 contact events per team per match. That's 1,000 contact events. Now, some of them are, I'm standing loosely at a ruck. That's counted as a contact event. There's no real risk to me. But hundreds of them are tackles and ruck entries and ruck defenses, contesting the ball in amongst fast-moving players and knees and heads and arms and shoulders. And the reality is that whilst the per player risk might be relatively low, when you put 30 players through that in 30 matches on a given weekend during peak rugby season, you are producing concussions. And those concussions have implications. And then there are, for every one concussion, there are hundreds of head impacts that don't reach the threshold to cause a concussion. They're what's called by some people subconcussive. I would call them non-concussive. But they may have health implications too. So the thing that rugby is grappling with is how does it continue to be a popular, enjoyed, embraced sport given the risk when the interventions designed to reduce that risk might change the essence of the sport? Because rugby wants to both embrace its physicality and downplay the risks that that physicality creates. And that's a real tension. So that's why rugby's dealing with it. And we are, there's lawsuits, right? Now, you don't...
I was going to say, the cynic in me suggests that we know what's happened with the NFL, where former players have brought legal cases against them saying they did not do enough to change. I mean, is
that's happened for rugby already.
So that is one of the reasons why. Is it the only reason?
No, I think, obviously the cynic in you and everyone else listening to this is going to say that, right? And of course it's a factor, because and it should be a factor, right? Because the law, by bringing lawsuit, the law is there to create a degree of accountability, to hold to account for not doing things that they should, whether that's negligence, whether it's deliberate, whatever it is. So and that's not saying that rugby must now say, oh yeah, you know what, we weren't. I'm not passing a verdict on what that lawsuit is going to end up as. But the law is a lever by which you can hold people to account, and the sport needs to hold itself to account. So yes, the lawsuit is there, but at the same time, I think there is a moral responsibility, there is a medical responsibility, and of course there's a legal responsibility to a young player, and we'll interview one of them now, to say, you're coming in at the age of 21. The last thing on your mind is your status in 2065 when you are 60-something years old, maybe younger even. I know that you're not interested in that right now. You want to play, you want to win, you want to be as good a rugby player as you can be. But the sport needs to take some responsibility for the consequences that that desire to play might have for your long-term health. And that is, again, a calibration exercise, because it's not to wrap in cotton wool. I think you referred to it sometimes as just wearing like those protective suits to try and minimize the risk as much as possible. That's not what you're trying to do. You're trying to calibrate that risk reduction so that you can have the same game with less head injury risk, both short-term and long-term. So short answer is, of course, there's a legal imperative, but there's also a moral imperative, a social imperative, a medical imperative to try and change that. And a performance imperative too, because a healthy player is a better one. You want to keep as many players healthy as you can.
Well, whatever side of the fence that you stand on this issue, we look forward to hearing your thoughts either on our Patreon channel or our Discourse channel or on Twitter or anybody where else you interact with us when you listen to this very fascinating panel discussion around this very issue.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm sure for all of you that have been watching our presentations today, you will see some fascinating research that I think kind of backs up a lot of what... the risk involved in rugby is, and there's no doubt that that is pronounced. And even though World Rugby is doing a lot in terms of its management of that, there's no doubt that there is some risk involved. So I'd like to welcome some of the guests that we're going to have on our panel today. And our first panel includes two very special people who are very experienced in the world of rugby. And of course, we're going to have Ross Tucker, who's going to be joining me very, very shortly. But first of all, we've got Kate Zachary, who's the American women's captain. A real player's voice in from the Ealing Trailfinders. She's a pro player, and she's experienced more than a decade in the game of rugby union and seven World Cups, and she's attracted a lot of interest around her, the sport of women's rugby in particular. And Ugo Monier, who is an English sports pundit and a former rugby union player, and for those of you in the UK, you'll know Ugo is one of the well-known commentators of the game, and not only on television, but also as a commentator on the state of the game as well. So welcome to both of you. So Kate, I'm going to kick things off with you first, and kind of from the player's perspective, when you see these presentations about the risks of the game, how do the players view the risk of playing the game of rugby union and any kind of rugby for that matter?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. it was interesting, especially listening to kind of these last few bits and trying to understand a bit more about kind of the outer view, I think, because when we, especially when we talk about that spectacle versus safety aspect, I think, particularly as bad as it sounds, you know, as an American, I think we have so much spectacle in sport. You know, if you think about the NFL and how exciting, that's what I think spectacle and how exciting the game is, but I also think of everything around it. So it's interesting to think about it from the frame of thought too, obviously the on-pitch spectacle. And with that, the law changes. You know, we've seen a lot taking place in the last few years. We've had bunker reviews. I think now we talked a lot through the head contact process, so the foul plays, the degree of danger and so on. But I think most interesting actually was that last bit around the subs. You know, I think when I think about the conversations I have in a locker room, I can't say any of my teammates are like, man, I wish we had less subs. That would make the game more exciting. Whereas I think what's interesting for us, you know, it's about that aspect of how you use your bench, how you use those impact subs, I think is that, you know, someone mentioned with Eddie Jones coining that term, but I think everyone uses it at this point about, you know, if you've got size and speed on the bench or if you've just got agility, it's what makes your team unique. And I think it's what's kind of exciting. You know, USA traditionally doesn't always have the biggest pack, for instance, but maybe we've got speedy wings and that's what makes our team unique compared to someone who has a bigger pack. We might opt less for scrums. We might choose more for a quick tap or lineouts or things. So it's interesting to hear, even with the sub spectacle versus safety, you can kind of see both, but yeah, so there's a lot of interesting conversations, but I think for the players aspect, you know, it is important for safety. And in the women's game, we have a lot of dual career athletes. So when it comes to stepping onto the pitch every weekend, whether it's for club or country, most of us have to go home at some point and work. And so I think from the safety aspect, it's important that you can still go to work on a Monday, be at training Monday night, Tuesday night, you know, on Thursday. So from that aspect, the safety is good, but also the spectacle is important. You know, we all want the women's game to keep growing as it is. And to grow the game, you need people in seats, you need an exciting level of rugby. And so I think it's important to understand why certain law changes come in, the importance of them, but also the ability to also change them. If the players have a voice and can be a part of that conversation, then I think we can always strike the right balance of science, but then also perception of players on the pitch and what they experience.
Yeah. Ugo, I want to bring you in. And obviously, you've had some heated debates online. And I saw an interview that you did where one of the people was actually saying that the game of rugby union should not be played at school level because it was tantamount to being child abuse. Where do you sit in terms of where the spectacle versus safety of the player is? Is it really an issue that you think that is something that people have to take very seriously? Or do you think this whole idea and this tension actually is kind of a bit of a non-story?
I definitely don't think it's a non-story. I definitely think it's a story that certainly needs to be had. But with all of these opinions and with all of these debates, I think the first thing we've all got to accept, it's so kaleidoscopic. Just speaking to Kate there, just about if she was to chat to her teammates about, hey, let's reduce subs. Players be like, no. But people who perhaps sit on the outside can perhaps understand, well, actually, what we need to create is more fatigue. Well, players don't want more fatigue. They want to be protected. So everyone has a totally different perspective of it. Safety is, I think, is one of the barometers which we can use to almost negotiate to understand the health of a sport. Because if at the very elite end that we can present a sport that looks like we're doing everything to be as safe as possible, then hopefully that drip feeds down to the grassroots where mums and dads feel safe for their boys and girls to be able to get involved in the sport. But it also then can become this self-fulfilling prophecy. The more we talk about a sport potentially not being safe, the more it almost feeds a seed of doubt into people's minds. Well, if they're debating it, is it because it isn't safe? And so it's trying to create that balance between creating awareness, having an informed debate, but also not scaring people off. Because I think we're perhaps at this biting point whereby I think there's so much work being done. I think we understand the sport better now than we ever have. But also, by talking about it, I also think we're scaring people off as well. Mm. So how do you circle that square? I don't quite know, but I do think the work which is being done is absolutely essential to create a game which is as healthy on the pitch as it is on the pitch for everyone involved within it.
Hugo, do you think that the spectacle is being affected by the rule changes that have been implemented in the last couple of seasons?
Yeah, absolutely.
In what way?
I think that's the whole point of creating rule changes, is to create a slightly different aspect of something. So whether it's a goal line dropout, whether it's just as one example, whether it's changing the rules with regards to kicking, which, if I could get into it. So, I mean, we debated it just last month. So there, every law has been created. I think every single coach and player tries to manipulate, right? So we have a rule at the moment that if you kick the ball 50 metres, so long as you're not within the 10-metre radius, you're effectively onside, even though you're 40 metres in front of the ball. So that perhaps is a rule that we need to take out because it actually inhibits players from running. It actually creates more opportunity for people to kick it. So I think rule changes are great, so long as it doesn't necessarily change the fundamentals of what makes rugby union rugby union. But I think it's a healthy thing that we're always looking at ways in which we can either create more flow in the game, create more ball in play time, create greater opportunities for tries, and also trying to consider that from everyone's perspective, whether it be the players, but also fundamentally the spectators as well. It's not that long ago we went into COVID and we said, our sport without fans isn't really sport at all. And now they're back. We're like, oh, I'm not sure if the fans' opinion is so important. Well, let's just go back 3 years. I quite simply think it really is quite important. So we do have to take on board what our consumers, what our customers, what our fans want to watch and need to watch.
Yeah, I'm going to bring in Professor Ross Tucker here, who's not only representing us here at the Science of Sport podcast, but is World Rugby's research consultant and independent scientist. Ross, I mean, this is something you're working with quite closely, literally day by day.
Yeah, so I've swapped one hat for a set of earphones. And so with these earphones on, I want to ask both players, actually, and for Kate, it's present tense. Hugo, you may have to dip into the memory banks a little bit. Both of your careers have spanned a period over which the culture around safety has really changed a lot. I'd like to know what your first reaction was when the safety initiatives and drives came about. Did you say, this is good, we need this? Or did you say, this is interference? And I want to have a candid discussion around whether the sport is grudgingly accepting safety initiatives or whether it embraces them as constructive as opposed to grudge purchases, if that makes sense.
I think it's interesting. There's probably a bit of both. I think some of it's obviously been reactive to things that have happened historically. I think you've got with that a tone of proactivity. I think, for instance, even with like the IMG, the mouth guards, I see the how that can be useful and important and things like that. I'll counter though, did we roll it out too quickly? In my experience with the women's game last year, we rolled it out at WXV. It wasn't well rolled out, frankly. And so it was one of those that players were a bit confused. I don't think they were confident in it or how it was being used. But I think then after learning more about it, you continue to then understand the importance and how we can use it. And even listening to what Lindsay had to say with some of the data, again, more and more, I'm like, this is great to hear about the differences of the men's and the women's and how we're going to apply it and things. Sometimes do we maybe roll it out too quickly because we are trying to fix a narrative that's out in the media? And is it actually for the players? Is it more to protect rugby and the union itself? And so it's always a bit of two of those worlds. And then how does it actually affect the players who are playing and have to kind of showcase the changes? And if you don't get their buy-in, it's also ultimately not kind of maybe not help the media flurry either, is it?
It's interesting that you talk about the media because it's one of the largest discussion points that we have in our game is head injuries, concussion, and what happens when you retire and the safety and the health of your brain. And they're all really important, obviously extremely valid. But I think there's loads of different sides to it. I'm just going to take one angle for a second, but that doesn't mean I'm to undermine or demean anything else, of course. And it's important I say that before people attack you. I think our sport is becoming... It's certainly over the last few years become scared of itself. And we're a physical contact / combat sport. That is the essence of who we are and what we are. And that needs to be celebrated. It's one of the reasons why people play our sport. It's why we choose rugby union over other sports, because it has a contact element. And whilst I understand there's different variations of our game, you can play tag, you can play touch, you can play all those things. I'm talking about 15s contact sport, and at the nucleus and the core of our sport is contact, and we need to celebrate it whilst trying to mitigate against and try and create an environment where it's as safe as possible. And the players need to be protected from themselves. And to answer your question, Ross, back in my day, and I retired 9 years ago now, I remember bringing in things like Cogsport, where we had to have a cognitive baseline test at the start of the season. Players used to cheat that. And by cheat that, I mean we used to, it might be a memory test, it could be a reaction test, but the lower the baseline level test that we had, the easier it would be able to actually pass it if you had a head injury or potential concussion. So were we aware of the effects of concussion? I think we perhaps knew enough, but by trying to cheat a system whereby you could return to play as quick as you could, that would perhaps understand that we were either ignorant or weren't informed. I think we're informed, we're definitely ignorant. And the number one factor or number one driving factor for us was getting back to the pitch as quick as possible. And why I know it's massively changed, because you look at the men's Six Nations, which finished just a few weeks ago. You've got a young gun like Emmanuel Feyobosa from Exeter Chiefs, and he played against Ireland. And it's interesting to listen to you just recently, Ross, about not necessarily delayed concussion, but how some of the symptoms can show themselves a little bit later. Well, Emmanuel Feyobosa, he played against Ireland, and then on the Monday, he reported that he had symptoms of concussion. To contextualize it, he's also studying medicine. I don't know exactly in what genre, but this is a player of today with less than 5 caps that is withdrawn himself from an international match and losing out on a cap because he totally understands the safety element of our sport. I think back in my day, had I had delayed representation of concussion, would I be going into the doctor on a Monday saying, I might have concussion, I'm not playing against France in Lyon this weekend and lose out an international cap? I'm just going to be honest. There is no chance, absolutely no chance I'd be having that conversation. And so I'm saying this not because, only because I think back in the day, it was perhaps a badge of honour. If you went down, it would be a case of just get back onto your feet. So it's really important to illustrate and underline how the needle and the dial has really change, not just people like yourselves on this call who are trying to talk about the safety element of our sport, but how it's filtered into players and that they truly get it and buy into it as well.
So, Kate, I mean, I think what you guys sort of suggesting is that you can apply a whole bunch of rules that will ensure the safety of the players, but getting the players to comply for their own benefit is probably the biggest tension between those two agendas.
Yeah. And I think Ugo brings up a good point. I remember when I first kind of got into 15s and I had my first experience of pre-concussion test. Yeah. It's like, if you get it too good, then are you actually going to pass it when the game? Because I think I remember years ago, I did one at a World Cup. And I think too, in that moment, post doing my concussion in the World Cup, I was like, have we also factored in though the emotion of doing a concussion test in the midst of a semifinal? I did one against New Zealand in 2017, and I had five doctors all staring at me, including my doctor. You've got a game on the line, representation for a country. And they're like, can you remember these seven words? And I'm like, no, I can't remember bubble, saddle, fork, anything right now, but it's not necessarily because I'm concussed. It's also because there's an emotional state and things. And I mean, as you learn and grow as players, it's some of it's experience of the player and understanding though. In hindsight afterwards, I was like, maybe I was a little concussed in the moment. Like Ugo's even saying, I probably would have argued to anyone to try to get back on that pitch. But the more you understand the symptoms, the more you understand the importance. But I think it's also a bit of trust as well. And that comes with consistency in your coaches, consistency in your medical staffing as well. And so not only do you understand the symptoms, but you also trust your team behind the scenes that, you know, Emmanuel, like for instance, he feels confident that he can go to his medical team, sit out that game, but that doesn't affect his relationship with the coach and his selections in the future. He's confident in his abilities and the coach's selection criteria that if he looks out for himself, that's actually good for him and the team. So it's kind of this layer of players' confidence and the team, players' understanding, and feeling confident to report those symptoms and then feeling that they'll be taken care of by the system. So it's a bit of like, how many rules do we put in place? How are those given to players and how are they actioned by the team who supports them?
Sorry, can I just jump off the back of that? I think the biggest thing is just truly understanding. If you look at the different categories and areas where players become solely responsible for their actions, whether it's in preparation, on the field of play, and then in recovery, whether it's your diet, your nutrition, your mental well-being, we almost need to be experts in all of those. And it's absolutely impossible for everyone to be experts. I remember the first time I went into training.
Hi, everyone. No longer Ugo, but instead me, because at this very moment, we had a technical failure, one of the pitfalls of doing a live recording. I don't know what happened exactly. Maybe someone somewhere decided to boil a kettle and make a cup of tea and they unplugged a crucial device. But basically what it did is it cut Ugo off for about 2 minutes. And unfortunately, the point he was making was lost. And so it falls to me instead to try and paraphrase what he was about to say. And that was that when he began training, he was told as a young player by the nutritionists that he needed to take creatine. And he had no idea what this meant, but he went along with it because that's what the experts within his team were telling him to do. And the broader point that he was trying to get at is that players will often do what they are told because they kind of have to. But if you really want them to come along the journey with you, you have to help them understand and take responsibility for what they do for their own professional performance and development. And for player welfare purposes, the same would be true. And so he was basically saying that a lot of the time the players are not necessarily aware and can't take ownership because they lack understanding around what some of those player welfare initiatives are. And part of that is because the players don't prioritize it. They just want to go out there and perform. And what player welfare is trying to do is often seen as someone else's problem, something they're not specifically interested in. And so we, the player welfare side, need to do a better job of educating and bringing understanding in order to change attitudes and behavior. So he made that point with better examples than I can provide and more eloquently than I can. But then suddenly the power came back on and we were able to resume from where he left off.
Yes. So Ugo, so given what you've just said there, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is Ugo Manya's knowledge of creatine back in your playing days and 10 is fully enlightened and aware of the safety risks, how well would you say players are currently educated about the welfare risks and the initiatives like mouth guards, law change, and so forth? Because I, I sometimes feel that we have great theory and we just really fall down on implementation, and education is such a big part of that. So actually, to both of you, like, where would you rate our ability to get the message into the stakeholders currently?
I think the effort made to get the messaging out would be at an all-time high, greater than I've ever seen it. But I think there's a number of things which need to be factored in. Whilst offering information is really important, it'd be no different to if during a team meeting, the coach starts talking about scrum play, I'm switching off. Whilst it might be relevant to me, it kind of bores me because I'm not in the heart of the action. And I often feel rugby players a little bit like that when it comes to brain health and concussion. We really need to understand and hear it. It's just not the most interesting thing I'm going to hear today. So I'll nod, and they'll put in time, that'll be before the start of the season, to talk about, hey, by the way, this has been brought in or whatever. So they'll be aware of it as to the degree they buy into it, of course. So I do think it is worth just noting that human behavior is something which is very hard to control, as well as it is for interest levels. But all the game can do is try and get as much information out there as possible. The other thing just worth noting is, whilst people campaign and often look and want for change, and I mean positive change, it's also humans' behavior to often resist change. Mm-hmm. And that's just a natural thing. I think it takes a little while. You get into this biting point where you get the change that you're looking for, you resist it, and then that change embeds in, and then you have a proof that the change that you've resisted is actually to the benefit of the game, and then it's there as if it's forever been there. So that might be my takeaway of that.
I think let's take the opportunity to bring in Sarah Byrne, who I'm going to ask Sarah just to switch her camera on because we want to see your face as much as we want to hear your voice. Sarah has had an international career with England under 20 as a back row forward, and since converted to prop, where she has thrived since taking on that position. She was Player of the Year in 2019, and she was shortlisted for the TikTok Women's Six Nations as well. So, Sarah, you come into this game as a younger member of the player fraternity. How do young players view the risk versus spectacle debate? Is there a concern over the risks involved in playing the sport?
I don't think so at all. It's not something that goes around the Red Roses group. It's a game, people want to play it. They want to play for fun. That's what everyone does. So really, yes, in terms of the high tackles, that's probably something, because that is something we know that is unsafe. So if there's a way that we can, manage that, which it has been far better managed within the women's game recently, it doesn't come up in conversation within the Red Roses camp.
Do you think there is within your fraternity, obviously there are, it's a fairly high level of the sport. If you look at the sport and its development and its younger players that are coming through, do you think there are some radical discussions about whether there should be contact at school level, for instance? What is your view on that?
I think there should be contact in school. I think actually it's far more dangerous. If you're not letting someone tackle and you're trying to get them to learn these movements, which are really difficult movements, when they hit puberty and their body changes, it's then twice as more challenging to get into those movements and be able to use those patterns well enough if you've not practiced it when you're young. So my personal opinion is that it's really dangerous if we take out contact. It's a contact sport. There's many contact sports. It's not a form of child abuse. If you don't want your child to play it, they don't have to play it, but I do think you're then limiting their opportunities and limiting who they're going to be around, and just limiting them a chance to live their own life. So I personally think that it's actually the wrong step. I think what we should do is teach really effective tackling and safe tackling and the concussion symptoms from a really young age, and people will start to look after themselves. We could get neck strength, that working through young age groups, because that doesn't happen, particularly in the women's game. You're lucky to get a strength and conditioning until you're in a premiership club. So, yeah, I think there's ways we can educate and we can make it safer. I think the wrong thing to do would be to take it out completely.
Yeah, that's actually you know, when Lindsay presented earlier, she showed a couple of slides and stats on the proportion of head accelerations that happen in training being significantly higher in women than in men. And then your first response to that is to say, well, you know what, we could actually manage the woman's head load by just intervening at the level of training. But the problem is those head accelerations might be necessary because they might be part of adaptation. And if you take them out, it's almost like, to me, analogous to saying to a marathon runner, you're going to race 42Ks, but you may not train more than 10. I know that marathon runners, A, not finishing and breaking down with injury. And that's kind of like what you've just said, Sarah, is has always been our rationale for also pushing back and saying, let's just be cautious about saying less contact in training. Because that contact in training might be the very thing that protects you in the match. It's another classic example of that trade-off where you can do something with every good intention and you end up creating an unintended consequence that makes the overall picture worse.
But there, are some complications in that, because at sort of the adolescent era, you've got players that might be the same age but different sizes.
Mm-hmm.
There might be young, you know, players who don't develop as fast as other players within their age group, and therefore the risk, injury risk, is higher. So I think there's a lot of evidence, there's a lot of logical argument to suggest that that might work. Do you still believe that that is still not good for the game in the long term?
No, I don't think so. I think that's where it has to be managed. If you if you're teaching effective tackles, chop tackles, that people's it doesn't matter. Like, it's different in the men develop so drastically different in the women's game. Like, if you have a larger player, like, try, if you teach a chop tackle, their legs are the same, their ankles will still be the same size as yours. Like, I think it's how do you cope? Is it safe? How is it being managed? Is there ways that that can separate out? I think getting rid of it altogether, I think, and my own experience, if I don't contact train, I feel it more playing than when I do regular contact training. And it has to be managed, because in a professional environment, you could get exposed to far too much contact. And then that's the other side, that's dangerous. Well, I think just the right amount where you feel the effects and you are more functional in the game, I think that's the most important thing. I think you look at people who have injuries, long-term injuries, they come back, they generally get injured again and again, and it falls into this cycle of having a long-term injury, exposure to rugby, a long-term injury, exposure to rugby. And that's what causes the recurring injury, because you haven't, like, the load has changed, it's too high. And I personally think when I'm exposed to more contact and in a safe environment, that's when I can be the best player I can be. And I think where I am today, because I was exposed to a lot when I was younger in a very safe way.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Let's bring in NFLB, who is an Irish senior rugby doctor from 2009. He went to the Rugby World Cups in that position in 2011 and 2015. He's an active member of the Irish sports medicine community and one of the most outspoken members around this. And I think, NFL, for us to hear from you from a sort of a medical perspective, what are your views on the spectacle versus a safety of the players scenario? Are we facing a crisis here in world rugby as a result of this tension?
Everybody wants change, but nobody wants to change. So that's the tension we have. And I think we all understand that and we all appreciate it. We will disagree at times, but we all want to get to the same place, which is understanding that this is a contact sport. People are playing it because they want to be involved in a contact sport. And our job in the medical department is to make that sport as safe as we can within the confines of understanding that it is still a contact sport. And we need to keep the essence of the sport going. So I think, you know, it's always good to hear from the people who are out there, who are in the middle of this, hearing Sarah's opinion on this. We've good data from, say, places like Canada, where a lot of women joining rugby join quite late, and their playing age is the big risk factor in their risk of head injury. So you know, that very much backs up the point of view of when you have a lower risk, your ability to teach contact at a lower age in a safer environment probably makes more sense than banning it until you have bigger athletes who are, you know, who have less skill and are attaining the skill set of tackling later. That's a more risky proposal than doing it when they're younger and they're moving more slowly and the objects that are moving are smaller as well. So I think there's a lot in all of this, and it's great to hear from from both sides of the approach today.
I'm interested to hear your views on what Ugo was saying earlier, this idea that is it not a case of it always being a compromise? Because you have to, if you can't go on completely safety and you can't go completely in spectacle, do you think it is going to be a case where there is a compromise on both sides of those arguments to keep the game in a safe space? And is it a constantly moving target?
There has to be. There has to be. And I think, you know, as Kate alluded to a while ago, where, you know, sometimes amongst the players there's a suspicion that measures that are being put in place aren't just for player safety, therefore to protect the game or to move that on. I think I start most of my talks with saying the health of our game depends on the health of our players. And if we don't have a healthy playing population who are happy and enjoying their play, we don't have a game. In the same way, as Ugo said, if we don't have spectators who enjoy watching the game, we don't have a game either. So there have to be compromises along the way in this. And I think, you know, what unfortunately in some of the age we live in, you know, I will always come first with a player welfare point of view. I will, if I could take every head contact out of the game possible, I would. But that's not going to be compatible with some of the things that players want to be able to do in the game. So I'm going to have to compromise on that. And other people are going to have to compromise in other ways. Where this debate becomes difficult is where people take a black and white approach and don't agree that there should be any compromise in this space. I think that there has to be for this to thrive.
Katie, just a couple of questions from people that are joining us on the chat today. One of them suggesting, and I'll read what it says here. I also heard both Kate and Ugo say that players feel left out of the decision-making process. In other words, only consulting them means they're tokenized, while the power to make decisions remains with people who believe, et cetera, et cetera. But what they're suggesting, Kate, is that players aren't involved enough in the decision-making process. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I think it's, I mean, if we're talking the context of games and trainings, you know, that comes with the trust of your staffing. I think when it comes to law changes and things like that, could we, you know, we've got different councils who kind of get feedback and things, but are they the loudest voice in the room? I would be hesitant sometimes of like, I'm not sure about that. But I think when it comes down to player management in the pitches and in the locker rooms, in your clubs and on your teams, it's a bit more about the education aspect. Do you even know what you're advocating for? And do you know how to advocate? And do you understand what it is you're advocating? Like Ugo kind of hinted at, do players even understand what it is they should be looking for? What are the symptoms and why are they important? And why should you flag them? What's going to be the process after you flag them? And how do you work through that? I think it's important to understand a bit of, as I look at it two points with that question as well. Like I said, is it the law changes? Do they understand? Are they part of that? But I do think day of, do they understand enough to make the appropriate decisions? Because if not, we're all going to make the decision to play. But that's too, I think we've hinted, that's where medical also has to come in. They have to speak with the player from the safety mindset of the player, the longevity of their career. And so I will say it's probably a bit team dependent, it's a bit individual dependent, and even experience. You know, me 10 years ago, I probably didn't feel like I had a voice. Whereas now I feel like I can also go to my medical team and say, look, I've got this thing going on. Here's what I'd like to trial first. What do you think with like return to play or even in a match? Here's the symptoms, but I don't recall this. I don't feel that, et cetera. I know now how to speak to medical. Whereas I would say 10 years ago, Kate would have been like, no, thanks. I'll keep doing what I'm doing because I just want to play.
What about at the world rugby level? And maybe I know, Ugo, you've been for the last 12 months part of the head contact process calibration group, which is a group that meets once a month and runs through some clips, and it's got coaches and players and former players, match officials and so on it. Because I think what Kate's talking about within the team environment is absolutely true. But, and again, I'm sorry if I'm asking a similar question to what I asked before, is it really strikes me that we don't speak directly to the players in the language that they need it to be said. And I want to understand from you, knowing that some of the inner workings of World Rugby, how we can do that better.
The only way we could do it better is by actually having players sat on those calls. I find it really interesting, just to give a brief summary of what those calls are. So we get sent some clips, all from match play, all around the world, and we get to decide individually as to whether the sanction of that tackle is play on, yellow card, red card, or whatever it is. And we debate it, and we try and formulate a library, which is then used to be able to use this guidance for referees going forward. I have these conversations offline with players, and I'll go 70% of our group, and it's a makeup, as Ross already said, players and coaches and everything else, referees, 70% thought that's a red card. What do you reckon? Ah, that's play on. I'm like, what on earth is going on? What do you mean? Like a straight shoulder to the head, no mitigation, and you think that's play on? Ah, yeah. So I find it fascinating, some of the players' opinions. And it really does vary dependent on your position, your club, and what hemisphere that you're in. Also, a lot of dependency is on the style of rugby that you play. So I think it's so important that we do speak to the players. And I sit there with World Rugby, part of the International Rugby Player Association. We have the RPA Rugby Player Association here. And they are certainly listened to, they're heard, and we try and lodge their opinions. We also feed it back, but I'm not quite sure what more else that can be done at this point. Players will tell me there's loads more, but we also need to hear that as well.
I got a question there from one of our watchers at the moment, Marcelo Saka, saying he's suggesting that if a game is a defensive game, can it not be as entertaining as a game where there are lots of tries? He's suggesting that if you have more rules and the spectacle is being affected by the fact that the game is much more defensive. And he's saying that a defensive game is as good as an attacking game with a high score. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. We spoke about it at a recent World Rugby match, a World Rugby conference. So England against South Africa in the Rugby World Cup, despite the outcome, that was fascinating. That was gripping, really. It was unbelievable, wasn't it? But so was New Zealand against Ireland, which is a completely different type of game. Loads of the ball in play time, you could not even compare. What we want in our game is jeopardy. I think the one word that often gets missing in these conversations is quality. We just want to see total quality in whatever it is, total quality in the execution and how a team wants to apply themselves. England gets South Africa. It was a wet, miserable day, but the quality of the scrum, the kick chase, the reception, as well as what was being done outside of that, I thought was so gripping. The jeopardy in the match went to 77 minutes, then we know what Pollard did. Ireland against New Zealand, there's no point saying, hey, want this free-flowing game, but players that can't go more than four or five phases, that's really boring, because what you think you started out as this free-flowing game ends up turning into a set-piece to set-piece game. The beauty of our game is that we can play the game of rugby in so many different ways. And to Kate's point, USA having quicker wingers but maybe not as big a pack could be combated by someone else. It's an absolute chess match, isn't it, where people are trying to figure out different ways to be able to find solutions. South Africa calling a scrum from a long kick from France because they wanted to put extra fatigue into the game. I don't really care much for scrums, but the South Africans make me care so much for scrums, and my value for watching scrums is all because I watch South Africa and how they really buy into it. What they do on the bench, the type of personnel they have, and Sarah's probably looking at me thinking, this is brilliant, we've got wingers talking about scrums, but I think so many teams can add so many different aspects to it, which we can all enjoy.
So then, given what you're saying there about how many ways there are to play rugby well and how many ways there are to enjoy it, and with reference to what was said last week by Rob Baxter in the news, I'm sure you saw the piece, Ugo, where he said rugby changes the laws too much. What are your thoughts? And same question to Kate, is does the sport change the laws too frequently in order to try and get ahead of patterns? And what would happen if it was just left for 5 years? Do you think the game would evolve in a direction that is good, or do you think it would evolve in a bad direction because everyone's trying to find another way to win?
I think from, we've got lawmakers, and then you've got playing group, that's coaches as well as players. I think there was a, and this is not a perfect comparison, but it's the only analogy I can think of right now. In cycling, way back when Lance Armstrong was involved, I felt as if like the blood doping and the ability to be able to cheat the system was way out of kilter. So the way in which they developed drugs was way more sophisticated than people who were trying to catch drug takers. If we left our game for 5 years, Kate, smiling, Sarah will absolutely understand, coaches will be able to manipulate rules at a far greater rate than we're actually changing them, 100%. In the same way Sean Edwards and I mentioned about the kicking drill and how Antoine Dupont and the French coaching staff absolutely have manipulated that and turned what was a nice kicking drill into something totally unintended, where we can see two people involved in a game kicking the ball 60 yards with 28 other players are playing stuck in the mud for minutes on end. We could just leave that for five years, or we could do something about it. We have an ever-changing game, ever-changing shapes, and I think it's really important that we try and stay on top of it.
Kate, would you agree?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it's two-part, because I find myself stuck in Ugo's argument a little bit, because I do think, to some extent, I want to leave some laws, because what I've found in the last couple of years is that we changed a few laws, but it's also not being applied equally across men's games, women's games, grassroots games, right? And even again, you tackle height mitigation, taking outside of like club games in England, it's Stirnham and the different things, but in the women's game, it's too far inconsistent. We don't have TMOs, our ARs are inexperienced. I think we've got some good ones, but we also have a lot of inexperienced because they're learning. But so then their understanding of how to implement this head action, or excuse me, the head process, is going to be different than one of the men's referees who's done, you know, 4 World Cups and 100 plus premiership games and high competitive games. Their way they implement is going to be far different than what we experience and stuff. So it's kind of two-part. I do think part of me says leave some laws, let them develop, but then let's make sure we're backfilling with the referee education, the coach education, and the player education. But on the other hand, yes, if you start to see the knock-on effects of a 50-22 a few years ago, then all we saw was kicking happening. But now people have figured out how to defend it, which is now exciting, but it's because we left it alone. We could have chopped it after a year and been like, nah, it actually hasn't worked out really well. But now teams have figured out how to defend better. Now you've got more people in the backfield, which now has turned to more running on the sides, because now people kick, they receive. After the third kick, like, I didn't get 50-22, but now Claudia McDonald's got the ball and we're going to send her down the wing and she's still going to score a brilliant try from 70 meters out now. You know, so certain laws, I think you have a knock-on effect, but if you give it time, teams figure out how to play with it better. There are other laws, though, that we've implemented, but do they need to be changed, or do they just need to be applied better? Do they need to be educated better? And that, again, isn't the players, but rather the referee support and the coaching support.
Sorry, yeah. Just on that. Sorry, Mike. At the recent World Rugby event we had last month, it was interesting. We're talking about the caterpillar ruck and how that just takes forever and an age, and perhaps we need to look at that and how to speed it up. I was sat there with an international coach who had a solution for what we can do to mitigate against that time which is taken up to do that. But he'd also found a way in which he could manipulate that to basically create another caterpillar ruck. So we found a solution, and he'd also been able to like crack the code of how he was going to manipulate that to do it. So coaches are already thinking about the solutions to the law implementations that we're already creating and how they can manipulate it to only better benefit themselves. So we do have to understand that coaches are spending many hours trying to tweak the laws in themselves to best suit themselves.
Yeah, just on that, and to give it a player welfare spin with a similar anecdote, is when the sanctions were introduced and we knew that it was going to cause a spike in red cards, there was one coach, in fact, more than one, a few coaches said, well, if you're going to ask the tackler to go lower, I'm going to coach the ball carrier to carry lower so that it makes it impossible for the tackler to tackle him. And you sit there with your head in your hands and you say, gosh, we're just going to create a race to the ground now. Because the coach is doing what his job is, right? He's trying to find a way to win rugby matches. And so they will always react to a law, and you have to try and anticipate that. And it's so difficult, because I was in the room when that same conversation was happening, and it was like a high speed table tennis match of one shot back and forth, back and forth. If you do this, I'll do that. I'll do this, you do that. That's where rugby's so fascinating, but unfortunately complex, and it's difficult to turn that into a public message, you know?
We've only got about 5 minutes left, so we're going to try and get to as many questions as we can. Another one that's come through says, we've heard the relationship between fatigue and injury risk and risk for concussion and other injuries is measured in match time played. How does this square up against the drive for more spectacle by increasing matches in club and World Cup level and reducing recovery time between matches? And I'm going to ask, maybe send this your way, because it's a difficult one, that, because there definitely is more player time, because that's what professional players want to do, But it does conflict with the idea that it increases injury risk.
Yeah, absolutely. So another one of the conflicts. I mean, if you ask a professional player what they want to do, they want to play games. That's how they earn a living. They want to win matches. They want to play in the big games. They want to be involved. So you've got a situation where, in one sense, you know, we have a scenario where there's a maximum number of games that players can play, but that figure at the moment affects a very, very small number of players. Where I think we would benefit from would be having a really structured preseason, having a structured break for players in season, and then having an understanding that there are pros and cons to this, and that there are different players who benefit differently from an individualized approach. So it's going to suit one player to have a break. It's going to suit another. Once they're going well, they want to stay going and stay playing and stay training. So I think there isn't a one size fits all to this. And I think one of the things which we are quite excited about is that rather than looking at games, one of the metrics for this could be head impact load. So if you're a back row forward and you're one of the guys that's getting the 12 impacts over 40 Gs in a game, as opposed to the guy who's getting two, then, you know, you should probably be having a rest a lot sooner than the person who's having less of those impacts. So you have a situation there where there's an individualized approach to that rest, trying to fit it in with a process where, you know, it's a game where people want to watch it and the players want to play it. So it's trying to find a way that is fair for people, that is fair for the players in particular, and that is individualized to help players achieve what they want to achieve as safely as we can.
My first thought hearing that, though, and I want to ask Kate this, is if that was the policy, and I agree, you could definitely manage load in a smart, targeted way in that way. What would the players do in response? We've heard about action, reaction. What's the reaction to that, you reckon?
Yeah, I think you're going to have some reaction. I was in a council call this fall, and we were kind of talking about, again, with the data and concussions and this and that, and I think you're going to have players who, they don't want to be told when they can't play. You know, I think obviously that's a huge factor, but it's just tough. I think the longer I've gotten in my career and my experience, I'm like, yeah, I would probably appreciate if a coach was like, no, you're going to take this 2 weeks. Like, you're not going to get unfit by taking this 2 weeks off. You've played 2,400 minutes of rugby in the last calendar year, which is something that's happened recently in the women's game. At least I know, even for the United States players, with when we're in the Prem to then when our Pac-4 tournament is in July, there's 2 years in a row where I only had about 10 days off from rugby and I played over 2,400 minutes of rugby because I played 80 minutes of almost every game, which isn't necessarily always a brag. Some of that comes too from, you know, we inexperience in our program. So it's about the development of all players, so you have depth in your bench, so you can rotate players, but also more importantly, it's about that calendar alignment aspect. So players can have windows where everyone's protected from coaches who want players to keep playing. But then how do you use that data, I think, within that? So when you come off, you know, even with the women coming off Six Nations, all right, you're a player who didn't play many minutes, but you also had these accelerations. Here's our recommendation of how long you need to be out from and things like that. I think it will be met with toughness because players do want to advocate for themselves. But I think if you give it plenty of education time over the next 2 years, you'll start to, and Ugo kind of talked about this earlier, I think the more you also talk and educate players, you'll start to get buy-in. You just have to know it's going to take time. And so it's about how we talk to the players, how you get medical to talk to players or coaches and things like that. So it is important for the longevity of players' careers. The more we add games, the more head impacts, the faster players get, the heavier, et cetera. I think you can get there with players, but yes, I think I've already encountered players when I've thrown out ideas. They're like, absolutely not. I would say no. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe we just need to find a different way to explain this to you.
You got your thoughts?
Agreed. We're talking about compromise, but I think compromise is such a negative connotation to it, doesn't it? Because it always automatically feels as if you're taking something away from me. But if we were to look at diet, we would never say, hey, you need to have a compromised diet. You'd say you need to have a balanced diet and you need X amount of this, that and the other. And no one's actually taking anything away. You're just having a number of things just in moderation. And it goes back to Kate's point about perhaps it is the same message, but just how you package it up and wrap it and sell it, it can be computed and feel a little bit more palatable. So I do think we need balance, and that's from everyone. Me as a broadcaster, what do I want to see? I want to see the best players as frequent as possible, but whilst understanding, we can't be seeing them every single week. And when we don't see them, that can't then be a story. Oh gosh, we're not going to get the head-to-head that we wanted. But ultimately, you need players to buy in. Like, I know there'll be some players that might, that fans and broadcasts will be expecting to see this weekend in a European quarterfinal, but have been given the weekend off because they need a weekend off. How that goes down, I think, is going to be really interesting and could be a really good case study for us going forward.
So final question. I know there's been some talk and there's some proposals out there about changing the red card rule where players can be sent off for a red card and after 20 minutes, a replacement can be put on the field to get the game. There's also a suggestion from one of our readers, from one of our listeners today, suggesting that maybe they reduce the game to 12 a side so that it's more of a running game and there's more space for players to be able to make a game more of a spectacle that way. I'm going to ask both of you just to finish things off and just to kind of give us your views on radical moves. Do you think there's a radical space for changing the game? Starting with you, Hugo.
I mean, I think there's other versions of rugby which have less numbers than 15, and I think it's called rugby league. So there are other options. I kind of want to keep rugby union, rugby union. We can tinker and get bored with, and sometimes you feel like you need to tinker for the sake of it, and oh, this might be better, but I don't know. I just keep the fundamentals of our game the same. What can we create within that to make the game as good as possible? I'm a huge advocate for the 20-minute red card or the orange card or however it wants to be characterised. And for me, the best example I've seen recently was at the Rugby World Cup. I think we've all established that most red cards that we see nowadays are actually more mistakes than any real intended foul play, a sidestep here or there, or someone just getting their technique slightly wrong. Sir Khaleesi, he got yellow carded, didn't he, in the Rugby World Cup final. Sam Kane, he got red carded. The difference between the tackle height is about 6 inches. One person is off for 60 minutes, the other one's off for 10 minutes. I don't know. I think 10, 15 years ago, when you're seeing people swinging and punching, and that classic red card is so different to what it is now. And I think we need to use the word, which has often got negative connotation, compromise, and be more in keeping with the mistakes that we're seeing that leads to a red card than just a full sanction. I'd go 20-minute red card with higher sanctions off the field. That would be my suggestion.
Kate, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think answer one, I agree. I came from sevens. I was new to rugby after leaving soccer, as we call it, or football, whichever your preference is. But so I think if you're interested in that fast-paced game, just go watch some sevens tournaments then. I think I've fallen in love with Union since transferring over, and I like it for what it is, the 15 aside with the complexities of scrums and lineouts. But don't get me wrong, if you really want something entertaining, go watch a sevens tournament, catch, I don't know, 100 games in 2 days and enjoy the speed and sport. But so yeah, as far as those radical changes go, I think leave 15s to 15s. But within that, you know, the 20-minute red card, I go back and forth. I think sometimes when I look at it, I think it does change the game. But on the other hand, if by allowing the 20-minute return, does it also change a team's behavior? And I think one instance I think about, you know, the England men, it was last year leading up to World Cup at one point, they had three men on the bench, all for yellow cards at one point, all with bunker reviews deciding what it was. And sometimes when I see that, I think, is that a team issue then? And is that going to be fixed by allowing them, let's say one person gets a red card, the other two go back on, but then they still get to add someone on. Does that change a team habit, a coach's habit and things? And that's where, you know, you can change the players' behaviors if you have that, like Ugo's saying, you know, you have 20 minutes, a different player comes on, the player who came off still has a higher sanction, that changes a player behavior. But let's say you start to see trends where it's a team. Well, now what are you going to do though? Are you going to start to penalize the coaches, or is it going to be a continuation of just those players if you see trends like that, which you do sometimes. You see teams who are more highly carded than others. And so then I'd be interested to go back to the training behaviors and what they're being taught in trainings and practices and coaches trying to manipulate laws. And so part of me still says, I don't think we're still ready for that, because once again, it goes back to application and education in trainings of coaches and of players holistically. And then if you can start to see trends go down team over team, do you then bring in the 20-minute red card to allow the game then to stay fast paced, knowing that the team, though, it isn't a behavior of a team. It just happens to be an incidental, someone dropped, you caught the shoulder, unfortunately. And it was less of a cynical red card, but it is a red card at the end of the day, isn't it? So I don't think we're quite there yet from my point of view, but it is somewhere I think we could get to.
Well, fascinating discussion. A big thank you to all of our panelists, to Ina Falvey, who's from the medical side, to Ugo Monnier and Kate Zachary, and of course, Sarah, who was with us just a few moments ago. She heads Leverley. Ross Tucker, who is with me. For those of you who want to see and listen to this podcast again, it will be live on the World Rugby site, hopefully this afternoon, if not tomorrow morning, and we'll be putting it out as a podcast on the Science of Sport podcast as well, sometime later today as well. So keep an eye out for that if you want to share that. But a big thanks to everybody, and for now, it's goodbye.
You have been listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on X, Facebook, Instagram, and join the conversation on our exclusive Science of Sport Patreon page.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.